This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. At the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, news articles with big headlines warned of increased divorces and the impending doom of otherwise happy relationships. Why? Because apparently more people stuck indoors meant more chances to find out how incompatible we may be. With us now is attorney Burton Padoff, who practices personal injury and family law. Burton, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
I want to talk about the initial stay-at-home orders that many people were under. We had schools shut down, work from home became a thing. How did that impact what you were seeing in your practice?
Well, initially, the amount of phone calls that I was receiving to start a divorce went way down. I would say the first 4 weeks or so of the pandemic, phones stopped ringing for new cases, but the phone calls increased for existing situations as people called for guidance.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice that were there cases on hold? I mean, I know some of the courts had to close down and things like that. Did that affect any of your cases?
I'm sorry, I lost you. I lost the connection.
Did you notice any of your cases? I mean, were they on hold during some of the courts that were closed? Did that affect any of the cases that you were going through?
Oh, absolutely. I had calls all the time from clients for existing cases wondering what was going on. And of course, initially, the first, again, 3 or 4 weeks, the courts and the clerks of the courts had to really scramble. We had stay-at-home orders, as you indicated. The courts we're not seeing people unless it was an absolute emergency, at least with regards to the family law cases. Then ultimately, and fortunately, and I say that with a long-term view of this, the courts developed the remote hearings for your standard type of hearings, such as a status or a pretrial. It took some time for that to happen. It took time for the legal community to become comfortable with that. And especially early on, and you may recall, there were reports about security glitches. And some of the court proceedings are confidential, especially with family law juvenile cases. But ultimately, we all became quite a bit more comfortable with that situation, with the scheduling. And long-term-wise, I hope that our courts maintain Zoom-type hearings for the status and pretrials where we're not really taking in any evidence. But it certainly makes it, what's the word I'm looking for? More transparent for the client, because it's easier for them before, if they were required to be at court for a status or a pretrial, they would have to take off of work. And now they may have to take off of work for a few minutes, but at least they're not having to take off for the whole day of going to court. I also have found that the courts are a little more time efficient when they're holding Zoom hearings as opposed to when they are in person. It's just a few minutes to bring someone into a case and bring somebody out physically if they're at the courthouse. But if you add a few minutes to 20 cases, all of a sudden we're talking about an hour or so. And now it's instantaneous. The court calls your case, you're there, and you're instantly mm-hmm. talking with the court. So it gives the court more time. And I also think that it saves the attorneys a lot of time, which ultimately results in a time and money savings for the client. I'm not having to spend as much time on their case for a status hearing as I did before, which is great.
Mm-hmm. I was actually just going to ask you that, like, okay, so is it cheaper now to get a lawyer if it's over Zoom? So I do want to ask you, you mentioned this workaround. So did that help for folks that were just like, I'm not waiting another month to stay with this person. I need this done now.
Well, the problem with that is even before the pandemic, that didn't happen now. You can file your case, but there's going to be a built-in time provision that the courts have where there are only so many cases they can hear at a time. So you may file a case, and if it's not an emergency, it's going to be at least a few weeks, at least up in where I practice, before you're going to get an initial status hearing on a case. The courts did have special provisions for emergencies during the initial, actually during the first week or two. I don't recall there being an emergency provision, but I'm sure there would have been. I don't believe our courts would leave people hanging there completely. They developed procedures for getting in quicker if it was really a sense of urgency. And people did have to come in physically. And of course, they would then practice the social distancing, and they had a system set up with regards to coming in, how many people could come in at a time, and of course, having the sanitation and things of that nature. So there were provisions, but all of us were very concerned about going into court, even on an emergency situation, so that I think our definition of emergency narrowed for a short period of time. It really had to deal with the safety of a child. Those always had priority.
Right. Well, I do want to talk a little bit more about the divorces that you mentioned. You saw a little bit of a lull in the first few weeks or so of the pandemic. Do you have any idea why that might have been?
Well, I think part of it was the courts was difficult. Those of us in the legal community didn't really know what the procedures were going to be. And when a potential client would contact me, I would have to tell them I have no idea as to how things are going to go in the near future. But I have no idea why the calls stopped, other than people were fearful of the unknown. And when things are unknown, the comfort level is what is known. And what was known is whatever family life they did have, whether it was a happy family life or not, at least they knew what to expect. I think that for some people, it might have helped their marriages. I think for others that it definitely did not. All of a sudden, they were having to adjust to being with someone 24/7. And unlike people who are retiring and finding themselves 24/7 where they can plan for that and ease into that situation, this was just thrust upon people. And all of a sudden they were having to talk with their loved ones where they really hadn't before. And I think that, and even the mental aspect of it, when you turned on our getaway, our television sets, what did we have? Virus. You change channel, you had virus, and none of the news was good. So you're putting, it's a toxic situation with the non-good news on top of what may already be a stressed marriage. And people react differently. And that's why I said some people may have strengthened their marriage while others found that they just couldn't be with that person like they had been.
Right. Well, speaking of the virus, did you see anything that this pandemic sort of changed dynamics in relationships?
Well, at least from ongoing divorces where we had visitation setups and things like that, it definitely changed things. You had people who were had a set amount of parenting time, but were in perhaps professions that exposed them to the virus more, and people had to address how they were going to handle their visitation with their children. And some people addressed it, hey, I will never put my children at risk. And other people felt that the risk wasn't significant enough to be of concern to them. So you had one parent thinking it's not a big risk and another parent who thinks it is a large risk. And we definitely had to work our way through that. The Supreme Court did issue orders very early in the crisis regarding how parenting time and support and things like that were to was to be handled. And basically, it was to be handled as it had been beforehand. And basically told the attorneys and the folks that had parenting time issues that you had to work it out. They didn't say that in so many words, but they basically said, if it's an emergency, you can get into court. But otherwise, we are looking at this as having no effect on our court's prior orders. And by our courts, I'm saying the trial court's prior orders. It made for a very difficult situation. But most people worked it out. And again, it really had to be a true emergency in my mind, where I had one case where, and I can't go into any specific details, but where one parent had a new significant other who worked in a high-risk area. And the other parent did not want the children being exposed to the significant other. Ultimately, by the time we got all the facts together, the 14-day period that the Centers for Disease Control had issued as a guidance had already passed. But that was one area where we went back and forth with that. And there was a provision which was used in our guidelines where we have parenting time guidelines that set forth when the non-custodial parent should have their visitation. And there's a provision in there for makeup time. So if extraordinary circumstances come into play and the non-custodial parent he or she is to have makeup time as soon as it's reasonably possible. So we turned to that provision, and that saved a lot of issues.
Well, it sounds like extraordinary times, extraordinary measures, and some new aspects that we haven't really thought about is where everybody's comfort level is and how that affects dynamics. Thank you so much. Burton Padoff is attorney and owner of Padoff Law. After a quick break, we'll speak with one of the researchers working on a study out of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University on whether people's relationships and sex lives were impacted by the pandemic. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The jokes were plenty when lockdown took place. Now, with more time on our hands and being indoors, that meant more sex and more babies, right? But was that really the case? We're joined now by Justin Lehmiller, a research fellow at the Kinsey Institute, host of the Sex and Psychology podcast, and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want. Thank you so much for joining us, Justin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, before we get to the research, can we get a little bit of information on what you do and how this relates to all of this?
Sure. So I am a social psychologist and I study human sexual behavior. I currently work at the Kinsey Institute as a sex researcher, and a lot of the work that I do tries to understand current trends in sexual behavior. And then I spend a lot of time not just researching them, but also communicating about those findings to the public, because there's great public interest and appetite in this topic. So last year, when the world started going into lockdown, we became very curious about what was going to happen to people's sexual behavior patterns and their relationships. And so we really wanted to collect some data, because a lot was being said and written in the media, but it was all based on speculation. And so we wanted to be able to speak to it from data.
Mm-hmm. And so tell me a little bit about this study. What was the process like trying to get people to begin with?
Well, it wasn't as difficult to collect participants for this study as, say, some previous studies that we've done. And I think part of it was because people were at home and didn't have a lot to do, right? There wasn't a lot to do besides spend time online. And so we actually had a pretty easy time getting a large number of participants. In fact, more than 2,000 people responded to our initial survey. And then we followed them for about 7 months or so with separate waves of data collection to try and look at different things that were happening as the pandemic unfolded.
Mm-hmm. And was this all people in Indiana, or was this nationwide?
So it was actually an international survey. So we recruited participants through social media. The majority of them were from the United States. I don't remember exactly off the top of my head, but it was between two-thirds and three-quarters who were from the U.S., and then the rest came from other countries.
Mm-hmm. And did you have to offer incentives for people to share personal details, or is it, as you said, people were just like, I'm not doing anything, I'm going to participate?
Good question. So for our surveys, we did have some incentives. So there were, you know, gift card raffles for participants to provide them with some compensation, which is pretty standard for how a lot of online samples are recruited. But again, we didn't really have a hard time getting a lot of people to respond to the survey.
Right. And so tell me a little bit more about this study. Like, how did you break it down? What were the topics?
So we wanted to study sexual behavior and relationships pretty comprehensively. So we asked people what they were doing by themselves as well as with a partner. We asked them about what their behaviors looked like in the year before the pandemic, and then separately how they've changed since the pandemic began. So we covered everything from pornography use to sexual fantasies to online sexual behaviors people might have engaged in. We also looked at what was happening in people's relationships currently. So how satisfied were they? How much conflict was happening? So it's really a comprehensive account of sex and relationships in the time of COVID.
Mm-hmm. And you know, earlier we were talking a little bit about some conflict that would lead people to divorce during the pandemic. Did you find any of that in your study, that there was a lot more conflict?
There was, and this is something that we've seen in our data as well as in some other studies that have been published. And one of the things we see is that there was this rise in conflict that was related specifically to the pandemic. So people were having conflicts centering around changes in their life circumstances. So, for example, inequity in childcare responsibilities for, you know, parents who suddenly had kids living at home full time and they had to deal with all the homeschooling. And then on top of that, there was also a lot of conflict around personal space and boundaries, because people were living on top of each other and not everybody has a home with enough square footage to allow people to have kind of some distance and space and separation. And what we see in the research is that for the people who experienced more of this pandemic-related conflict, their sex lives took a bigger hit. So they were less sexually active. And then when they were active, the sex wasn't as good. So this was something that really ended up pushing a lot of couples apart.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can attest to being in a small space. I live in a small apartment, and I'm always telling my kids, I need alone time. Do not bother me. Leave me alone. It's really rough, especially when you're in lockdown and you can't go anywhere. So what were some of the things that, or some of the thoughts that you had before going into the research that you found wasn't at all what you thought? For example, I don't know, I'm assuming if I was doing this research, I'd be like, oh yeah, people are going to have more sex because they're stuck inside and there's nothing to do. Did you find any of that to validate some of the thoughts you had going in?
Right. And so that's what the popular media narrative was. So in March of 2020, we saw all of these media reports saying people aren't going to have anything to do but have sex or masturbate. And so there were lots of media reports about how pornography use was spiking, about how there was going to be a big COVID baby boom because people were having a lot more sex and so forth. But what we actually saw in our data was that the trend was towards less activity and not more. So overall, sexual behavior and sexual desire dropped, especially in the early phases of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We did see some changes when we look longer term over time where, you know, for example, initially among our participants, sexual behavior and masturbation and pornography use, all of these things went down. But then later on, over time, some of those things started to come back. So, you know, it was a temporary blip in the radar, but it was a long-term one. And most people reported struggles rather than improvements. But I think it's important to point out that this pandemic was a story of different effects for different people. So we did have a small number of our participants who were even more sexually active during the pandemic than they were beforehand. So, you know, again, the effect just wasn't consistent on everybody.
Mm-hmm. If you have any questions or comments for our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, or you can send us a digital voice message with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Justin, I'm just a little curious. What is it about us as human beings that make assumptions that because people are cooped up inside, there's nothing else to do but have sex? Is that just where our brain goes to?
Well, I think there are a few reasons why people might have thought that. And one is that they may have looked at previous research on what happens during natural disasters and other emergency situations. And there is some research supporting the idea that, for example, in the case of hurricanes and other very time-limited emergency situations, that sometimes small baby booms follow those situations. So I think some people may have reasonably thought that the effects here of this pandemic would parallel that of other disaster and emergency situations. But this was an unprecedented situation that went on for so long, and there were so many social and other restrictions accompanying it. And so I think we just didn't have a template for what to expect here.
Mm-hmm. And does this research compare to anything at all, or is this very unique?
So our data are unique in that we really started collecting data at the beginning of lockdown. This was actually the fastest research project that I ever had in my career, where from the moment we came up with the idea till when we were collecting data was just a matter of about 2 weeks or so. And so we were really able to get that timely data and then follow these people over time for about 7 or 8 months. And so it's a really unique data set from that standpoint. But there are certainly a lot of other studies that have been conducted over the last year or so. And I think ours is unique and provides an interesting picture, especially at that early phase of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that as stress increases, people's desires decrease, or do some people cope with stress by craving intimacy?
So this is one of those areas where stress can have different effects on different people. The modal effect, or the most common effect, is that stress tends to put a damper on sexual desire. And this makes sense for a few reasons. One is that when you're really stressed out, it becomes very difficult to get in the mood for sex because your mind is wandering, it's distracted, you're thinking about that stressor. So it's very hard to feel desire and arousal for a lot of people. But by the same token, there are some people who cope with stress by turning to sex. And we do know that sexual behavior can be a stress reliever. So for example, in studies where you look at couples on days that they have sex, they report feeling less stressed the next day. So, you know, again, stress can have different effects on different people, but most commonly it tends to put a damper on desire.
Mm-hmm. Now, your study wasn't just about sex, but also about romance and relationships. So what were some of the key findings in those areas?
So one of the things we saw was that early on, when it comes to romantic relationships, most people, it was much more common for people to report struggles rather than improvements in their romantic relationships. Over the course of time, though, we saw those people who were reporting challenges, you know, they started to drop and the number reporting improvements increased. So the situation was very challenging early on for relationships, but many people appeared to figure out kind of how to adapt to the circumstances over time, which I think is a positive sign. And when we look at more recent studies and data on people in relationships, we do see that, you know, for all of the talk that there was about how there would be a big divorce boom, it turns out that very few people who said that their relationship struggled during COVID are actually planning to get divorced now. So again, it seems as though people have learned to adapt for the most part to these circumstances, and some couples will come out even stronger in the end.
Mm-hmm. And did anyone mention in the study, for example, like how they were coping in their relationships? Like what were some of the things that they did to deal with the circumstances they were in?
Yeah. And again, this was one of those things where it was a little different for different people depending on their circumstances. So, for example, mm-hmm. many of our participants were in long distance relationships. And so, and also many relationships that you wouldn't typically consider to be long distance sort of became long distance during the pandemic, right? Because even if you live in the same city, but you don't live in the same apartment or home, and you can't go out and see each other the way you did before, a lot of people kind of had to experience what it was like to be in a long distance relationship for the first time. So we saw a lot of people turning to more virtual activities and behaviors as a way of cultivating intimacy, and also not just cultivating intimacy, but also cultivating sexual intimacy. So we saw a lot of people mm-hmm. report engaging in virtual sexual behaviors as well. But one of the things we saw was that for the couples who were doing the best, they were the ones who were most likely to try new things in the bedroom. So experimenting and exploring sexual novelty was really one of the key defining features of the people who did the best in their relationships over the last year.
Mm-hmm. And so how long is this study going to be going on for? I know you mentioned that you did this maybe a couple of different times, or correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, so we had 7 waves of data collection that spanned from March through October, November of last year. And we're gearing up to do another wave of data collection very soon, because we want to explore what's happening right now, and also how are vaccines changing people's sexual behavior patterns. So for example, are people going to feel this sense of perceived invincibility once they're vaccinated? And will that lead to an increase in casual sex and other types of sexual mm-hmm. behavior? So that's one of the things that we want to explore in the new phase of data collection.
Mm-hmm. And how many versions are you planning to do of this? Is this something that started, when the pandemic happened? Is it going to continue indefinitely, or do you have sort of like an end goal in mind?
So in the beginning, when we started the study last March, we didn't really know what to expect. And I think we at first thought, maybe this would just be a one-time thing. But as the situation wore on and it became clear that there was no end in sight, we adjusted our plans and added more waves of data collection. And so I think as long as the situation sticks with us and as long as stress and anxiety remain high, we'll keep adding on new waves of data collection, because this is an unprecedented situation. And I think the more we understand about what's happening and who's struggling and who's thriving, and how we document all of these things can help us to better prepare for future situations like this, so that maybe it's not as challenging the next time around.
Mm-hmm. Well, were there any other similar studies being conducted that you were able to collaborate with, or that you found that there were different results?
Yeah, so there are several other research teams that have looked at changes in sexual behavior and relationships during the pandemic. And we've actually collaborated with some of them, combining our data to work on manuscripts where, for example, they might have asked about questions in a somewhat different way, or asked some questions that we didn't think of. And so we're using that to be able to triangulate our data and really get the best possible answers. In terms of the overall picture of what COVID research has found, our results are pretty consistent with what other people have reported, specifically there being that drop in sexual behavior, a lot of the challenges and struggles that people have experienced, the rise in conflict, but then also that increase in novelty-seeking behaviors serving as a buffer is something that has emerged in some of the other studies as well.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the plans with all of this research? What will happen with this information?
So we've started publishing some of our results. Our first paper came out last summer, and we have several others that are under review at journals or are, you know, we're currently in the process of writing them up, and they all explore different aspects of what happened. So you can expect to see a steady stream of papers coming out in the coming months and years.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Justin. Any final words?
Sure. So, you know, I think when we're talking about the impact of the pandemic, again, it's just important to recognize different people experience very different things, but we were really pleased with the sort of remarkable adaptability and flexibility that was evident in our participants, showing that we can adapt to really challenging situations.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. Justin Lehmiller, a research fellow at the Kinsey Institute. Coming up, we'll hear from two experts on gun violence and crimes to try to understand more about what happened last week when several people were killed after a gunman opened fire at an Indianapolis FedEx facility. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam So. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Another mass shooting, but this time it hit closer to home for Hoosiers in Indianapolis. Eight people were killed last week when a gunman opened fire before turning the gun on himself. These kinds of tragedies often bring up conversation about gun control, mental health, and even questions about why these things happen in the first place. With us now to understand more about crimes and guns, we have Ari Davis, senior policy analyst at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, and Tom Stuckey, executive associate dean Paul O'Neill, School of Public Health and Environmental Affairs. IUPUI. Tom, I'd like to start with you. When you first heard about what happened last week, what went across your mind?
Well, first, thank you for having me. The very first thing that I always think of in this situation is what a tragedy it is. There is a far-ranging effect of these kinds of situations for the victims, families, for their communities, and for people who experience this through the media. And so it's always a deep sense of loss and tragedy. So that's the first thing that I always think of, whether it's a mass shooting or whether it's an individual homicide victim.
Mm-hmm. And Ari, you follow things all across the country. When you heard this happening in Indiana, what crossed your mind?
Thanks, Miriam, for having me. And yeah, just echoing some of what Tom said. I mean, the first thought is just of the victims and the families and the community that's been impacted by this tragedy. I mean, I think as working for a gun violence prevention advocacy organization, we see this with regularity, right? And whether it's covered by the media or it's the daily gun violence that happens across our country, this is something that needs to be addressed. And those were some of the things that were going through my mind when this happened.
And you're mentioning that this is something that needs to be addressed. And I think that's on everybody's mind is how can we address it? It just seems like every single day it's another incident. Will there ever be an end to this?
Yeah. So I think when we're looking at gun violence, we need to look at, what the scope of it is. And right. So mass shootings is one small and really tragic portion of this public health crisis that we face, right? 60 gun deaths a day are gun suicides, right? And so we need to look at all the different aspects of gun violence, whether it's domestic violence, whether it's interpersonal, whether it's homicides and communities that are disproportionately impacted. And we need to find a wide range of policy solutions and programs to address these variety of different aspects of the problem. And so I think first framing it as this public health crisis that it is can help us understand that it's going to take more than just one policy, to really address this.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, do you agree that this is a public health policy issue?
Absolutely. So if you look at the scope and the scale of the impact, it is far beyond what these are not isolated incidents. There are communities that children experience the aftermath of these tragedies, whether they're individual shootings or more victims, and those effects are far reaching, and they are on the health not only of children but of adults, and they can have long lasting consequences. So absolutely, this is a public health crisis.
And Tom, for people that want to know what can be done to prevent these things from happening in the first place, I know that just seems like the million-dollar question, but what is the answer to that?
Well, thank you. I appreciate you asking. The one thing that I would start with is that this is a series of related problems and not a single problem. And as a consequence, looking for a particular solution and holding any particular public policy up to the standard that it has to prevent all fatal shootings or non-fatal shootings, mass shootings, individual homicides, that's unrealistic. What we need is to think of this like a public health issue, like traffic safety, for example, where there are many, many, many policies that come together. To start with, we do need to look at mental health supports. There are many, many, many people in this country who have experienced tremendous trauma and are unable to process that. Some of them turn that to anger. Not very many of them, but some of them do. And so that's one example. So we need to do a much better job of identifying individuals that are suffering from the aftermath of this trauma or have difficulty managing their negative emotions. We have, frankly, we need to have a more serious conversation about the availability of firearms to people who really probably shouldn't have them. We have some laws in place, but there are not the resources to really follow up on concerns. And in particular, it's really hard to know of the individuals who have given some reason to believe that they're concerned, which ones of those will go on to commit and act like what happened.
Mm-hmm. And Ari, I want to kind of follow up on this with you. We hear often that there's mental health issues in some of these incidents, but, you know, then we also hear, for example, these individuals were known by law enforcement to have these issues, and yet they were still able to purchase a weapon. How does that even happen?
Yeah, so I want to start out with just kind of acknowledging that, you know, mental illness, millions of Americans suffer with mental health and mental illness. And, you know, that is, you know, we want to make sure that we're not stigmatizing entire, you know, generalizing entire populations. I think when we look at specific behavioral risk factors for violence that a lot of these individuals exhibit, like this, this individual, there's specific policies that can be put in place to temporarily remove firearms from those who are at elevated risk for violence. And so, you know, Indiana has a risk warrant or extreme risk protection order. Some people call it a red flag law. And I think it goes back to kind of what Tom was saying in terms of you can have laws, but we need to make sure that they're implemented and that the stakeholders, whether it's law enforcement or community family members or you know, the courts, know that these laws exist and that these laws should be used when someone is showing clear risk signs and making threats of violence to themselves or to others. And we know that in Indiana, while it didn't work in this case, we know that there's a number of studies looking at Indiana's extreme risk protection order and showing that for every every 10 orders served, one suicide was averted. And so we know that these policies can work, and it's just it's a matter of implementation and education around effective policies.
Mm-hmm. If you have questions or comments for our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Now, I do want to ask a little bit about how the pandemic has affected some of these crimes. Are we seeing an increase because people are finally going out and before everybody was inside? Tom, what are your thoughts?
Well, thank you for the question. It's really challenging to identify a consistent way of defining these incidences, and oftentimes the public awareness of a particular situation is only loosely related to the frequency of the occurrence of something. So clearly what I would say is that the conditions for seeing improvement in the situation during a pandemic are unlikely. In other words, one would expect that the precursors to these kinds of situations are probably at best neutral or worse. The conditions, I like to think of it, probably the easiest analogy you could use is you know, whether it's an extreme drought situation and you don't know exactly where a wildfire is going to occur in that extreme drought situation, but you know it's very much more likely. And I think a pandemic increases all of the stressors that would lead to gun violence. And I would remind the audience that when we are talking about gun violence, we're talking about not just mass shootings, we're talking about individual or smaller number of events that don't always necessarily make the news, and suicide. There are a tremendous number of firearm suicides in the U.S. every year, as I already pointed out. And so we really do need to look at all of those things. And I would say that the pandemic probably makes each one of those potential situations likely to be worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, you're mentioning that it's not just mass shootings. There's so many other factors where gun violence is part of it. It makes me think that we're not even hearing the numbers of what's really going on. If these certain incidents grab headlines, but then there's so many other things that are happening that we don't know about. Ari, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think when you look at mass shootings and the high profile mass shootings that are talked about by the media, it's, you know, it's less than 1% of all gun deaths, far less than 1%. I think it's, you know, these are tragic instances and we should be, you know, talking about them. But at the same time, we should acknowledge that, you know, over 100 Americans die every single day by guns. And during the pandemic, you know, obviously, and for good reason, the media is focused on the pandemic. But we saw around a 25% increase in interpersonal gun homicides. And it's that's like preliminary data. But in 2020, we saw a huge record-breaking spike in homicides. And so we need to ensure that there's, you know, both investments and kind of the root causes of those, you know, that's led to that spike in violence. And we need to, you know, pass stronger policies to prevent gun violence.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, you know, even in the journalism realm, there's been discussion on how these topics are reported on and how this can lead to more crimes being committed. Is that part of the problem? Are reporters part of this problem?
Well, it's a complicated question, but I think there's at least some pretty good evidence to suggest some, maybe not all, but some of the individuals who commit acts of mass violence are looking at previous individuals. And particularly in the school shooting case, it's not uncommon for there to be a narrative around the idea that the individual is idolizing prior mass shooters. And sometimes they will read up on those individuals. They will try to potentially one up those folks or add their own name to that. That's not the only thing that potentially the media could be contributing. And certainly one of the things that I would recommend would be to spend time talking about the victims more than about the individual that was engaging in the perpetration of the act. So certainly it doesn't help. I think the social media and our broader media, I would not just put it on journalists. I think there is certainly a natural curiosity that you would expect here. But the attention certainly does not help from the standpoint of potentially providing examples for individuals to say this is what has been done and what I might do myself.
Mm-hmm. And Ari, how does Indiana and even the U.S. compare? I don't know if you've looked at things outside of the U.S. in terms of these kinds of horrific crimes, whether it's mass shootings or just a lot of gun violence. Does anyone compare at the level of the U.S.?
No. No developed country compares to the level of violence of gun violence that the U.S. has. And the underlying factor is easy availability of firearms in this country, right? We have more guns than we have people in this country. And so, again, it's just like you look at the data from other countries, and there's similar number of like property crimes and crimes committed in other developed countries, but not even close to the number of homicides and gun crime. So it's a gun, when it comes down to it, it is a gun problem.
Mm-hmm. And so what would the solution be? I mean, I know I kind of asked this earlier. I know there's prevention, but you know, the U.S. is not going to get rid of weapons anytime soon. So what would the ideal situation or solution be?
So I think it starts with passing universal background checks to make sure that everybody who wants to purchase a firearm has to go through just a basic background check. I think that is like the backbone for any gun policy in this country. I think Tom provided a really good analogy of the auto safety in this country, and taking a really comprehensive approach and looking at, just like we, with cars, we made cars fit safer. We had airbags. We required driver's license. Cracked down on drunk driving. Those same kind of approaches can be used in gun violence prevention, right? You could have to get a license to get a firearm. And in fact, a number of states have that. You could make firearms safer in terms of the technology. You could prevent access to firearms from people who are at elevated risk, whether they've shown signs of violence. So there's a number of different policies and that a number of states are passing, but we need to pass them at the federal level to really address this public health crisis. And it's not about taking away guns, right? Like no one was saying we should take away cars when we wanted to make cars safer, but it's about making it safer for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, what about when it comes to Indiana? I mean, what's the solution here?
Well, I think Indiana is in some ways unique, as all states are, but in many ways is very typical. So, the challenge that you run into from the standpoint, as you know, already mentioned a number of things that are certainly within the realm of reasonable firearm regulations that would not involve, taking firearms away from everyone. And in fact, that's probably not only would it be infeasible, but it's probably not going to make a difference from the standpoint. There's just a supply of firearms that would make that really difficult to imagine how you could accomplish that, even if someone was able to. So I think, when we look at the things, I would say that there, in addition to all of the firearm regulations points that Ari mentioned, the areas that I would want to focus on would be things that are truly going to move the needle in terms of a longer term approach to prevention. And frankly, when we talk about mental health, and I do want to reiterate the point that I already made, that very often folks that have mental health issues, they're much more likely to hurt themselves than they are to hurt other people. It occasionally will happen that they do hurt others, but most of the time they're going to be more of a danger to themselves. So we know that there is a much greater risk of suicide when a firearm is in the home. So keeping those locked up. Talking to individuals who are experiencing stressors in their lives about how to cope with those, having connections in the community. And frankly, we need an awful lot more money on mental health, period. We just do. And so it's again, not to say that we should stigmatize individuals, but definitely need much more prevention kinds of things, treating folks before they get into crisis.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining us today. Ari Davis, Senior Policy Analyst at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, and Tom Stuckey, Executive Associate Dean, Paul O'Neill School of Public Health and Environmental Affairs at IUPUI. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Join us tomorrow as we look at efforts to tackle homelessness. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.